City of Denison and Dallas, two cases combined for oral argument. Dallas Central Appraisal District versus Seven Investments and Dallas Central Appraisal District versus La Cunha Corporation. The parties have been previously advised of the time for oral argument, and you may, the petitioners may reserve some time for rebuttal by informing the marshal of that time. The arguments are being recorded for the benefit of the court. The parties may make application, however, to hear these arguments by making application to the court. We're ready to proceed on the first argument.
May it please the court, Mr. Norman and Mr. Williams, to present the argument for the petitioner. The petitioner will reserve 12 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Norman will open and Mr. Williams will then be rebuttal.
May it please the court. My clients are two excess insurance companies doing business in the state of Texas. Excess insurance carriers who conduct business in the state of Texas should be afforded a legal remedy to bring causes of action against primary carriers and their agents for their conduct in the handling of a jointly insured claim. The vast majority of other jurisdictions in the United States that have addressed this specific issue have afforded such a cause of action. We are basically here to talk about two things: the vehicle through which this cause of action will be afforded, and then the accrual of this cause of action and the applicable statute of limitations. I will first discuss the legal theories that have been used by all other jurisdictions.
Have all these other jurisdictions extended a cause of action as against the attorneys retained by the primary carrier?
Not all, but Rousseau versus Rochford in New York has extended it to what's called attorney malpractice.
Those that have denied it, have they done so on the lack of privity?
Some have used privity. I address that specifically because I think privity is somewhat becoming cryptic in our economy in light of the fact that this court eliminated the necessity of privity in our DTPA litigation. And I think this is a perfect example where the removal of the privity requirement will not create a conflict of interest between the lawyer, the primary carrier, and the excess carrier. For this reason, if ordinary care is used in the defense of a jointly insured claim, there is no conflict between the insured, the lawyer, the primary carrier, and the excess carrier, because they are only interested in one thing: effective representation and defense of the claim.
This court has held that the attorney hired by an insurance company owes a duty of unqualified loyalty to the insured, and recognizes that often an attorney may have a conflict of interest as between its duty to the insured and the insurer. Isn't the duty you propose vis-a-vis the excess carrier, doesn't that complicate it further?
Let me address that in this way. This is the most unique attorney-client relationship that we have in this state or this country. It is the only situation where the insurer, the client, doesn't get to pick his lawyer. He doesn't have to pay his lawyer. But yet he has an absolute duty to cooperate under the contract with the person who picked his lawyer and who paid his lawyer. The excess carrier simply stands in the shoes of the insured, for had the insured not purchased excess coverage, then any amount over the primary coverage would necessarily be the personal financial obligation of the insured. For that reason, if the lawyer conducts a reasonable, prudent investigation of the claim and defense and pretrial discovery, their interests are consistent. I think the most logical case that has ever been handed down in this area is the Spinks case in California, which uses a doctrine called triangular reciprocity. Now, we already have equitable subrogation in Texas through the employer's transport case. It was a co-insured claim. We do not have the direct duty concept, although direct duty has been employed by other jurisdictions. But the reason why this reciprocity makes so much sense is economically it'll work this way. The insured has an absolute duty to cooperate with the primary carrier. The insured has an absolute duty to cooperate with the excess carrier. The primary carrier has a duty to the insured, and in the event he would be exposed to an excess judgment, that primary carrier and or its agent lawyer owes that same duty to the excess carrier. We have the doctrine of equitable subrogation, so therefore American Centennial and First State ascend to the equitable rights that General Rent-A-Car would have had in this underlying action, because General Rent-A-Car was the one faced with the adverse judgment. And it was General Rent-A-Car who demanded my clients pay $3.6 million to avoid this judgment. The second matter, like I said, there are three theories, three ways we can go. We already have equitable subrogation. We could go so far as direct duty, because I think privity is an eroding concept in light of our DTPA trend. But the reciprocity argument makes me, my client, have a duty to the primary carrier, so it's equal for everyone. Now, with regard to the accrual of the cause of action.
What is that duty?
With regard to the accrual?
The excess carrier's duty to the primary carrier.
The excess carrier has to monitor the litigation if he's placed on notice. He can advise the primary carrier with regard to settlement, not settlement, reserves, or what they should do with the case. But he can't ignore his relationship that he ascends to through the insurer.
You say the interests are aligned. Actually, they're quite different. For as in this case, if the claim greatly exceeds the primary coverage, the primary carrier's best interest is simply to acknowledge the claim and tender the limits. But that may not be true for the excess carrier.
Under the facts of this case, it was such a tragic situation, and it was so hopeless that General Rent-A-Car's own personal counsel, Mr. Becker, said, pay this claim. The carriers, the excess carriers, simply honored their fiduciary obligation of good faith and fair dealing, went forward and honored the request of personal counsel for the insured to settle the claim.
Well, for example, if the primary carrier has only $100,000 of coverage, and the excess carrier has from that limit to $10 million, and there is a claim that clearly exceeds $1 million, but probably does not exceed $5 million, the primary carrier is in an awkward position trying to defend and settle that claim.
They have been paid a premium dollar for the position that they put themselves in, and by their contract, they assume the duty and the right to defend the claim to the best interest of the insured. If counsel can realize that it's going to go in excess of the primary coverage, the duty to defend does not cease for counsel. He must go on and defend, and then the excess carrier picks up the financial obligation over and above that.
Their only duty to the insured under those circumstances, if there were no excess carrier, would be to tender the limits.
Correct. Or if they tried the case.
But you're adding a different duty to them. Not only they cannot merely tender the limits if there's an excess carrier, they must defend the case in the interests of the excess carrier.
If there is no duty, then no excess insurance company in this state will have a legal remedy at law to seek money damages if it is injured as a result of negligence. We will have no remedy.
But if there is a duty, the primary carrier becomes obliged to try a case that it has no interest in, maybe even contrary to its interest.
Or settle the case.
It can only settle by tendering its limits.
Correct.
$100,000.
I still don't see the conflict, though.
How can the primary carrier with $100,000 of coverage decide whether $1 million or $5 million is a good settlement when the excess carrier has $10 million of coverage?
Well,
the primary carrier has no basis for deciding. It's the excess carrier that has the interest.
I respectfully disagree. Under the duty to provide defense counsel, simply because the primary limits are exhausted, that contractual duty contends. Maybe there is excess coverage, maybe there isn't excess coverage, but that same duty continues, and he is the agent of the primary carrier based upon this court's holding in Ranger versus Gwynn.
What is it? What is the nature of the duty? To act with ordinary care? Or
act as an ordinary, prudent, reasonable attorney would do.
The briefs use good faith and fiduciary. from time to time in the arguments. You're not contending that that standard should be that of a fiduciary or of a good faith, are you, or are you?
I think our court has already said that there is a fiduciary relationship between a lawyer and the insurer. We've already established that.
Between the primary carrier and the excess carrier, is the relationship that of a fiduciary?
I think it would be quasi-fiduciary in nature because they have a jointly insured economic interest. They can't, in the economic reality of our society, the primary carrier can't go stick his head in the sand and say, well, I really don't care about your interest in this case, because it's to the insured's benefit to have that excess coverage, and the primary carrier and his agent lawyers can't simply just put blinders on and look at to one portion of what the insured's assets are. He has a duty to look at all the interests of the insured.
Ordinarily, the burden is on a fiduciary to prove that he did act in good faith, not upon the other person to prove that he did not. Would that be true in this case?
I think with regard to extending attorneys' responsibilities of bearing the burden of proof in charging fair fees and stuff like that, I think the attorney would have a burden.
Counsel, I'm talking about, in these questions, the burden of the primary carrier with respect to the excess carrier. Is it your contention that a primary carrier who is sued by an excess carrier has the burden of showing that he handled the claim in a proper manner?
Yes.
Thank you.
With regard to accrual, and I need to move on quickly, there are a series of cases by this court that are controlling. We can start with Leichenhoger, go to Atkins versus Crossman, Street versus the Honorable Court of Appeals, followed by San Jacinto versus Murray, and then our most recent opinions on November the 21st, Park Hill and Higgins. In these types of situations, the cause of action, whether it be for negligence, gross negligence, DTPA, Article 2121, or Stowers, all have a two-year statute of limitations. It is at that point in time when there is a final judgment and all avenues of appeal are lost is when the cause of action accrues. For this logical reason, if we are required to sue a lawyer every time a lawyer makes a mistake, but yet, for example, admitting liability where there was no liability at all in this case, then you would be required to sue your lawyer within 2 years before the case may ever even be concluded and the lawyer having an opportunity to rectify that mistake. That would be a system of justice we couldn't live with. The attorney has a continuing obligation and he may rectify his mistake. There was an attempt in this case made to withdraw the admissions, but that was denied by the trial court. For that reason, when this lawsuit was filed January 21, 1988, it was within the two-year statute of limitations because on February 3rd, 1986, the final judgment in the McDonald versus General Rental Car case was handed down. It did not become final until 30 days thereafter when all motions for new trial would have been overruled by an operation of law. Therefore, the case being filed within 2 years is clearly within the two-year statute of limitations. The Court of Appeals has erred in distinguishing Stowers surviving to my clients, but negligence, gross negligence, DTPA, and Article 21 not surviving to our clients. If you read G.A. Stowers, it says they are required to exercise ordinary care in every aspect of the litigation, the investigation, the pretrial, the defense, and subsequent to trial. For that reason, it is not logical that the Court of Appeals preserves our Stowers claim, but takes away our claim against the agent lawyers and Canal on the theories of negligence, gross negligence, DTPA, and 2121, because they're all part of the same two-year statute. My time is up and I need to sit down.
May it please the Court, Mr. Black and Mr. Hitchcock, and argument for the respondent, Mr. Black, will open.
May it please the Court, my name is Bob Black. Along with John Renster, I represent Canal Insurance Company, the primary carrier here. We'd really like to address three points. We may not have time to get to the third, in which case Mr. Mitoff will take care of it. But the first point we want to address is to discuss whether this is, in fact, a Stowers cause of action. The second point relates to what sort of a cause of action is it if it's not a Stowers cause of action, and what sort of statute applies. And the final area of argument is that of what doctrine should be applied here in terms of equitable subrogation, direct duty, triangular reciprocity. With respect to our first point, which we've contended all along, is very simple one, that this is not a Stowers cause of action. In the G.A. Stowers case in 1929, the court held very properly that a Stowers duty arises if the carrier has the opportunity to settle the case within policy limits, if the carrier negligently fails to do so, and then later there is a judgment in excess of those policy limits. In this case, not one of those elements of the Stowers cause of action were met. First of all, there was never a demand within the primary policy limits. In fact, the first demand in this case was for $4.0 million in October 1985, a year and a half after the lawsuit had been filed. Secondly, there's just no evidence in this record whatsoever that would indicate that my client, first of all, had the opportunity to settle, but second, that there was any real chance that this case would settle for $100,000. This is, after all, a double fatality of two young women. The case has substantial damages from the start. The American Centennial and First State have conceded in their briefs all along that the damages in this case far exceeded $100,000 from the inception of the case. And that's found at page 5 of their brief in the Court of Appeals. Finally, there has to be a judgment in excess of policy limits. There is no judgment in this case in excess of the overall policy limits. There is a judgment in excess of the primary policy limits, but not the overall limits of $4 million. In short here, to characterize this as a Stowers cause of action, we think carries the Stowers obligation too far. The main case on which American Centennial and First State rely for their very expansive reading of the Stowers doctrine is the Ranger Mutual County case versus Gwynn. Now, they cite Gwynn for the proposition that the law firm is the agent of the primary carrier. And in oral argument here this morning, you heard that again. But that does an injustice to the language of the Gwynn case. The Gwynn case specifically held at page 659, we held in Stowers that an insurer which under the terms of its policy assumes control of a claim, investigates the claim, and hires an attorney to defend the insured becomes the agent of the insured, and the attorney becomes the sub-agent of the insured. The insured, not of the primary carrier. Now, Justice Gonzales, in his dissent in the Gwynn case, very presciently noted the problems in sort of blithely applying agency law to this whole area. And I do quarrel some with the result in Gwynn. I think it's overbroad and expansive. But even for the proposition they cited for, it doesn't support that proposition. It does not support the proposition that the attorney is the agent of the primary carrier. In fact, we know, under Employers Casualty Company versus Tilley and its progeny, that the attorney who is retained by the insurance company owes his obligation, his sole responsibility, to the insured, not to the insurance carrier.
But the primary carrier ought to have some responsibility not to gamble with the excess carrier's money, should it not?
I absolutely agree.
And what is that duty? The same as, for the same reasons that the duty of ordinary care is imposed on a carrier to not to gamble with the insured's assets in excess of the coverage?
I think it basically amounts to the same thing, which is, first of all, did they investigate the claim properly? Did they hire a reputable law firm? Did they take the steps in the handling of the defense of the insured that were in the interest of the insured?
Is it a duty of ordinary care?
It's a duty of ordinary care. Absolutely. It is not It is not a fiduciary obligation, as American Centennial and First State have argued here. This is all also consistent with the language of the seminal case in G.A. Stowers, in which the court itself held that the carrier's obligations run to the insured. And that's the real meaning of Stowers. It was a controversial issue in the late 20s, and the court of the Texas Court of the Commission on Appeals correctly decided it. What we claim this case really is, if Stowers does not apply, is that it's a negligent claims handling case. Now, there may be a cause of action by the excess carrier, which they're equitably subrogated to the insured's interest, for whatever negligence occurred in our handling of the claim. But in this case, there is no evidence in the record which indicates that my client, the primary carrier, in any way was negligent in its handling of the case.
How about the admissions about the defective tire?
I think that that is a very significant point, but my client, the primary carrier, played no role in that. It was the admission filed by the attorney on behalf of the insured without the knowledge, frankly, of either General Canal or the excess carriers. The only notice my client received, and this is in the record, was an after-the-fact copy, not of the request for admissions, but of the answers to the request for admissions. So we just got an admitted with no copy of what the legal significance of it was.
Wouldn't you be responsible for the negligence of your sub-agent? Or of your agent, I'd rather, the attorney you hired?
If the attorney, Justice Cornyn, is our sub-agent, it seems to me that the proper line to draw there in terms of responsibility for that sub-agent's conduct is to determine what degree of participation or collaboration or contribution that the insurance carrier had in the matter. Here, we had none.
So it shouldn't be vicarious. It ought to be depend on the care with which you selected the attorney?
Well, or whatever other facts are there in the record to determine what degree of monitoring control was exercised. In this case, there's no real control being exercised over the attorney. The day the accident occurred in May 1982, my client was notified. They hired the independent adjusting firm of Lindsay and Houston. They retained the lawyer. They immediately investigated, obtained the accident report, photographs, consulted an expert. 2 years later, the lawsuit is filed. This is a classic example where my client did the right things and trusted the judgment and the expertise of a very accomplished law firm.
Are you saying that the excess carrier ought to have a right of direct action against the attorney that your client hired?
Your Honor, of course, that's theoretical. I don't agree with that.
They don't have a cause of action against anybody.
I do agree with that point. If, however, the court decided to the contrary on that, there might be something in the doctrine of equitable subrogation. I think that the direct duty theory or the triangular reciprocity theory are very, very weak. They impose duties on parties that weren't bargained for. They impose duties and obligations on parties that have very conflicting and different interests. And I was astonished here this morning to hear that the interests of the insured, the interest of the primary carrier, and the interest of the excess carrier are all identical. Well, they're not. There is a tremendous tension between the primary carrier and each level of excess carriers coverage. In an instance where there are multiple layers of excess coverage, there's even more tension. Not only that, there's tension and a conflict of interest between the insured and the various layers of excess coverage. For example, the facts of this case, the primary is $100,000. The first excess went to $1 million. And then American Centennial went to $4 million. If the settlement demand had been $1.25 million or $1.5 million, somewhere above the first level of excess, but within the total coverage, there's going to be some pressure existing between not only the primary, but between the various excess carriers to get the case resolved. And likewise, you see that also if the demand is at the point of the first layer of excess coverage. If it's 1 million, at that point, the excess carrier with the larger coverage is saying, settle this. Protect my dollar. And rightfully so.
If the primary carrier has a duty of ordinary care to the excess carrier, do you say that the excess carrier has any duty to the primary carrier?
Your Honor, I don't concede that the primary carrier has any duty to the excess carrier.
At all?
At all. In my judgment, whatever duty does exist would flow from the exercise of the responsibilities by the primary carrier to the insured. Now, if this court then adopts the doctrine of equitable subrogation and says that the excess carrier stands in the shoes of the insured, then they would have some of the rights.
I don't understand what sense that makes. The insured doesn't have a claim. He never has had a claim.
Doesn't have a Stowers claim here at all. I agree.
Or doesn't have any kind of claim.
That's right.
This is a claim. These contentions are all among the respective insurers as to how the claim is handled.
I agree with that.
But if there is no duty, then what is the answer to the argument that there is nothing to prevent the primary carrier from mishandling the claim?
The way that I would approach it, and it can be approached any number of ways, regardless of whether the Stowers cause of action exists, and we know it does not exist here because the insured was not harmed, there's still this obligation to investigate the case properly, to handle the negotiations, to handle the conduct of the case properly if that's violated. And if that results in some damage to the excess carrier, I would give the excess carrier a remedy through the doctrine of equitable subrogation rather than impose some sort of direct duty.
Isn't it, in reality, with multiple layers of insurance and dealing with an insured, isn't this really just a complicated game of chicken that takes place in every lawsuit like this where there are multiple layers of insurance? Because, in effect, the primary carrier has two duties, one to defend and the other to pay to its policy limits. And then once it pitches in, it still has a duty to defend, but it's, in essence, gambling with the excess carrier's money, is it not?
That's absolutely right. And moreover, we're not talking about the original situation that existed in Stowers, where the furniture company had bought a policy of insurance for $5,000 and someone was injured. We're talking between primary and excess carriers, large, sophisticated companies who've entered into a contractual bargain. And it seems to me that it's not appropriate to extend to that excess carrier the full panoply of remedies that we give to the insurer. And it seems further that if we embarked on a course where we gave a duty to the primary carrier to the excess carrier, that actually we're disserving the interests of justice and actually promoting the filing of more litigation. And the reason I say that is if there is that duty, the excess carrier in every case will have a financial incentive in the negotiation of the case to try to find areas in which the claim could have been handled better. In other words, to get the primary carrier to pay more than its limits, to extinguish any liability that it might have for negligent claims handling. What is going to be the effect of that? Well, the first effect could be that it could delay the settlement of a case that ordinarily would have settled. This deprives the plaintiffs of their money, and causes the case to linger. Even if that case is settled, as it was here, then you have the ensuing litigation. And it seems to me that to impose that duty simply opens a door that's inappropriate to open. It seems to me that we should go back. I think that we should take the language in Gwinn very carefully, read it for its facts only. The truth of the matter is that Gwinn was a negligent failure to settle the case within policy limits. The demand was $19,500. The policy limits were $20,000. There's a judgment in excess of that. I think we should be careful about applying agency principles that where there's really no rationale to apply those agency principles. There was a rationale in 1929 for the Stowers case. We don't believe that there's a rationale now. Thank you.
May I speak to the court? Mr. Nipoff, for the respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Richard Mithoff. I represent Henry Giesel and his law firm. The Giesel law firm filed certain responses to requests for admission. Those responses were based on an expert report that was in their possession at the time that indicated that there was apparently a defective tire on the vehicle and that apparently that defective tire caused the accident. When subsequent events cast some doubt on the expert's opinion, Mr. Giesel's firm filed a motion to withdraw those admissions, and they commenced additional discovery and investigation into the facts underlying the claim. The first motion to withdraw was denied. A second motion to withdraw those admissions was then filed following extensive investigation and discovery, and that second motion to withdraw the admissions was pending before the trial court at the time the excess carriers decided to voluntarily settle this case. The excess carriers voluntarily settled this case without waiting on a ruling from the trial court on the second motion to withdraw admissions. The two attorneys retained by the excess carriers, Mr. Wheelis and Mr. Lawrence, undertook to settle this case for approximately $3.7 million and then turned around and sued the primary carrier, Canal, and the attorney retained by the primary carrier, Mr. Giesel, seeking three times the amount of the settlement they had just negotiated and seeking at the same time a substantial fee for doing so. I want to address briefly, first of all, the contentions by the excess carriers that the Hughes case should apply with respect to the statute of limitations. This court, of course, held very recently that the tolling exception will apply in a legal malpractice case where the attorney commits malpractice in the prosecution or defense of a claim that results in litigation. With respect to the Hughes case, I would point out, first of all, that the excess carriers have not pled nor proved a tolling exception. There is a long line of cases in this state that requires a party that seeks to rely on an exception to the statute of limitations to, at the very least, plead the exception on which the party relies. There is no pleading by the excess carrier of a tolling exception. This court recently in the Willis against Maverick case, holding for the first time that the discovery rule applies in a legal malpractice action, nevertheless denied that relief to the party in that case because the party failed to submit the issue on the discovery rule in substantially correct form. I would further point out, with respect to the Hughes decision, that the underlying rationale of that decision was based on the conflict that would arise to the client in contending on the one hand that his lawyer was negligent in their malpractice action, and on the other hand, contending that the lawyer was not negligent for purposes of the trial or the appeal of the case. There is, of course, in this action, no trial and no appeal, and there was no evidence of that conflict. With respect to the duty issue raised by the excess carriers, I would respectfully submit that the trial court and the Court of Appeals were correct in holding that there is no duty under the circumstances of this case owed by the attorney retained by the primary carrier to the excess carrier. There is no court of which we are aware anywhere in any state in this country that has ever held that there is such a duty, and the several cases that have squarely addressed that issue have held that there is no such duty. The Michigan case, which is cited at length in the brief, was presented with that very precise issue. That is, an allegation by the excess carrier that the attorney retained by the primary carrier acted as agent for the primary carrier, and that the excess carrier was therefore equitably subrogated to the rights of the insurer. The court held under those circumstances that there was no such duty because it would present an obvious conflict for the attorney who has a duty to the insurer, not to the excess carrier. Here there is a clear inference from the evidence and from the transcript of the settlement conference that occurred in this case that the excess carriers and their lawyers were involved not in a good faith settlement, but in a setup against the primary carrier and the lawyer retained by the primary carrier, presenting a clear conflict for the lawyer who is charged with the duty of representing his client and his insurer. The excess carrier is not without protection in these cases. The Continental Casualty case, which is a federal district court case cited in our brief, squarely faced this issue and noted, for example, with respect to the remedies of the excess carrier, quote, to the extent the excess insurer considered itself at risk in the state court suit, it could have retained counsel to monitor the litigation and to protect its interests. Continental is hardly a neophyte in these matters. What it asked this unwilling court to do is to sanction a procedure whereby an excess carrier can remain silent, yet challenge the defense and strategy in the face of an adverse judgment. Equity does not mandate such a result. The excess carrier, virtually by every contract it enters into, retains the right to demand that the primary tender its limits and retains the right to demand that the defense be tendered to the excess carrier. This is a case, I submit, in which two excess carriers remained silent about strategy during pretrial procedure, refused to retain counsel until the eve of trial. Once counsel was retained, insisted on a settlement rather than a trial, and once it was settled, blamed everyone else. This is a case where the same two lawyers who negotiated a settlement turned around and sued for three times the amount of the settlement and retained or claimed a substantial fee interest in the outcome. This is not a settlement. This was a setup. This is not a case where this court should fashion an equitable remedy, holding for the first time that the attorney retained by the primary carrier owes a duty to the excess carrier under the circumstances of this case. And we would respectfully submit that the trial court and the Court of Appeals should be affirmed in all respects with respect to Mr. Giesel and his law firm.
Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Midoff, I have one. I see that your firm name is listed as Midoff and Jacks. As you know, Mr. Jacks is my former law partner, and I continue to own some rental property with him. Is he involved in any way or stand to benefit in any way from this action?
He does not, and he has no fee interest whatsoever in this matter.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Counsel.
Mr. Court, Mr. Williamson will present
the rebuttal
for the petitioner.
May it please the Court, I'm Jimmy Williamson. The eloquent statement presented by Richard Midoff is factual in nature. And that's all we're asking here today, is the chance to present our case to a jury. Mr. Midoff makes his compelling arguments that the law firm did nothing wrong and that the excess carrier did a whole lot wrong. All we ask is the right to have our day in court for that very proposition.
How many masters can a lawyer have when we've said in Florida's Casualty versus Tilly that the lawyer has an unqualified duty of loyalty to the insured, you would have us say that he has a duty of loyalty not only to the insured, but to the primary carrier and to the excess carrier as well, would you? Is that your argument?
Well, let me answer it this way if I can, Justice Cornyn. We can tell it. The very Kelly case talks about conflicting interest of lawyers because it seems to recognize, Kelly seems to recognize, and no one here, on our side anyway, seeks to change this rule, that a lawyer has an unqualified duty of loyalty to his client. No question about that. Whether it's a Kelly insurance situation or whether it's just a normal attorney-client situation, that's definitely the rule. Now, the reality of the situation is when a primary hires a lawyer and pays a lawyer and has a continuing relationship with a lawyer, that lawyer also is going to have a duty to that primary carrier. And in fact, Tilly, I think most of the defense bar argues, Tilly recognizes that there's a dual loyalty. It's just that, and here is the key item in this, to me in this matter. If there is a conflict, the lawyer's duty must lie with the client. The reason that is so important in this case is in this case, in the ACIC case before the court, there is no conflict. The acts of negligence of which we complain concerning the request for admissions do not have anything to do with the dispute between the excess, the insured, and the primary. They are acts which compromise the defense position in the case substantially.
There's no conflict between the excess and primary insurers in this case?
Not in, well, there's a conflict in the sense that we're not getting along. It's true.
You're suing each other.
Is there a conflict in the sense of, if one of us wants the lawyer to admit liability, and if one of us wants the lawyer to not admit liability, was there some interest of the client to be served by admitting liability while there was some opposing interest of the excess or primary? The answer to that question is no. The excess, the primary, and the insured, in this case, all wanted liability to be defeated. So the question that, to me, the threshold question when you talk about these duties that run between the parties, is there a conflict? If we were dealing with a situation where a lawyer should give one piece of advice to the insured, even though that piece of advice may not be in the excess carrier's best interest, the decision of this court would be easy. A lawyer must always set with his client. But when we are dealing with a situation where the events are identical, namely a full and complete defense to the client, the lawyer should not be able to commit a tort and then take his fiduciary obligation to lessen his responsibility. The fiduciary obligation of a lawyer should heighten his responsibility, not lessen. And what he's doing here, the business of insurance and the business of tort law, is the allocation of risk. That the compensation for the law, all tort law, in this state and any state, is premised upon the concept that the wrongdoer should bear the loss. It should not be different in a case where one party has the good common sense to buy excess insurance. We don't ask anyone other than the wrongdoer to bear the loss. That's the only rule we're asking for from this court. And in response to Justice Heck's question, since we stand in the shoes of the insurer, whatever duty the lawyer owes the insurer is all we want. Whatever duty the primary owes the insurer is all we want. Is there a conflict in a case when you have a $2 million lawsuit and a $100,000 insurance policy? You bet there's a conflict. But the existence of excess coverage does not create the conflict.
But whether the lawyer owes the excess carrier a fiduciary duty ought not to depend upon the existence of a conflict between the excess carrier and the insurer.
The lawyer owes his fiduciary obligation to the client. The question then becomes for this court, if a client has the good common sense to buy insurance, should the excess carrier stand in the shoes of what is an already existing duty? There's no creation of a duty. The lawyer owes that duty the moment he signs on. The question is, should the excess carrier be able to accept that duty as a person who stands in the shoes of the insurer?
Why shouldn't the duty of most be one of ordinary care?
Well, I suppose that in the duty of what this court says it is, obviously. But I think the duty for the excess carrier should be exactly the same as the duty that the lawyer and the primary owe to the insured. There's no question that under Arndal or Randa or Ranger or Stowers that the attorney owes a fiduciary obligation to the insured. The primary owes a fiduciary obligation to the insured. I do not see that that duty should be lessened because an insured has the good sense to buy excess insurance. And in fact, if you say the excess doesn't have the benefit to the duty, what you've been done is in effect change the underwriting rules. Because what you've said to an excess, you will now not only insure general rental car for liability coverage, you will also insure general rental car for the misfeasance of its attorneys, and you will also insure general rental car for the misfeasance of the primary. So what you're doing is you're putting on excess coverage or surplus lines carriers an additional risk that, of course, and we all know this, the marketplace will bear the risk. The surplus lines carriers will reflect that in the cost they charge. It's not a plaintiff defense issue. It is an issue in the insurance industry in which, quite frankly, all insurance carriers who carry both primary and excess are going to benefit from a detriment defense. Why? Because the loss will flow back to the tortfeasor. If the tortfeasor is the adjuster, the loss flows to the adjuster.
Counsel, if this is such an issue in the insurance industry, why are there not more cases on it?
There are, Your Honor, with regard to, there are many, many cases, as I'm sure the court knows, in question of the primary and the excess. Overwhelming, complete, vast majority, federal, state, I forget how many jurisdictions, 30 or 35 jurisdictions, have all held that the excess has the right to pursue stand in the shoes or pursue a cause of action to get reimbursement from the primary carrier. Why there are no, I assume the court's question therefore is concerning attorneys. Why are there not more cases against attorneys? I submit to the court that when you look at the Michigan case, for example, that Mr. Midoff cited, what the excess carrier was complaining about in the Michigan case was that the lawyer did not advise the excess carrier regarding settlement property. Well, this gets into a question of conflict. What should the lawyer, to whom should the lawyer's advice solely flow? Namely, to the benefit of the insurer. There's no question about that. So in cases in which there's a conflict, I don't see any problem at all with saying the attorney's duty runs too far. What I'm saying is, in cases in which there is no conflict, the attorney should not be able to use this as a shield from liability. The answer to why there's no cases, Judge, is because I think, quite frankly, the issue of legal negligence is kind of an emerging field of law. And I think the court knows it. Other than that, I have no answer for the court's inquiry as to why there's not more cases.
How are you going to know whether there's going to be a conflict at the front end as opposed to in retrospect?
Well, I think, Your Honor, it's going to be very easy. Let me put that answer in the context of this case. The court should remember in the summary judgment evidence in this case, Robert Becker is the vice counsel of General Rent-A-Car. He's not associated with the excess carrier. He's a lawyer. He's not associated with the excess carrier. He's not associated with the primary. He's not associated with any of the attorneys. He looked at this case after the request for admissions had been admitted. He heard from the excess lawyer, he heard from the primary lawyer, he concluded, and this is in the summary judgment record cited in our brief, he concluded that liability on this case was law. A double death fatality against the target defendant, he demanded my client pay the policy limits to get him out of this trap. Because General Rent-A-Car could not stand the heat of taking an excess verdict in excess of $4 million, for which they were uninsured for everything over $4 million. Right? So in that context, is there a conflict under the facts of this case? The answer to that question is no, because all parties in this case had an absolute expectation and right, and in fact the primary carrier had a duty to defend, which is distinct from its duty for coverage, as your question previously noted, charged a premium for that duty to defend, and got paid for that duty to defend, which is contractually assumed. and they did not comply with that duty to defend. In terms of vicarious liability, in that same regard, duty to defend was assumed by the primary carrier. The primary carrier had that duty to the insurer because he contractually assumed that duty. And therefore, when that duty is breached, the duty to reasonably defend, it stands to reason that the primary carrier who received compensation for that, for the assumption of that duty, the primary carrier should be the person responsible for seeing that the duty's discharged properly.
Counsel, would you briefly address Mr. Mithoff's argument that this was not a settlement in good faith, but actually you set him up?
Well, I don't think the facts bear that out, Your Honor. Here's what happened. In 1984, requests for admissions were admitted, which admitted a product liability tax. The plaintiff immediately non-sued the plaintiff and plaintiff's lawyers for whatever reason, obviously figuring out that they had a solvent defendant who was well insured in a double death case and realizing they had a prima facie case of liability, they non-sued the other defendants. Once they non-suited the other defendants, of course, it does not take much of a lawyer to figure out exactly where they're headed at trial with a prima facie case of liability and huge damages. That came to light in 1985, Your Honor, when in fact the lawyers for the primary carrier started trying to withdraw their request for admissions. The trial court refused that. Well, of course, once the trial court has now ruled that not only did you admit liability, but I'm refusing you permission to withdraw your admissions. And now, the vice counsel for the insured gets involved. He meets with the lawyers for the excess, and he meets with the lawyers for the primary. And the insured says, we have lost this case on liability. Damages are horrendous. I demand that you settle this case, even if it takes your entire $4 million.
Should he have waited until the trial court ruled on the second request to withdraw the admission based on another expert's or further evidence or further newly discovered evidence or another opinion of another expert?
Well, I think when the court, I haven't put this, but we'll be happy to file a supplemental brief on it, Judge. Let me say what the summary judgment record reflects and the depositions in the case reflect. The plaintiff's lawyer had said, if you go forward with the second hearing, I'm withdrawing the $4 million demand. Now, and my follow-up to that comment, Your Honor, is when the plaintiff lawyer says that, the excess carrier, who clearly has a Stowers duty to his general rental car and clearly has a fiduciary duty, he's put between a rock and a hard place. He can either take the position that he's going to take a chance if the plaintiff lawyer is bluffing, at which time he subjects his own insurer to an excess judgment, or he can wait for the second ruling. And my response, the legal response after telling the court those facts, Justice Gonzales, is to say those are questions of fact. Did the excess carrier mess up in doing that? Did the primary carrier mess up? Did the excess carrier mess up? That's a question of fact upon which, quite frankly, this law firm has one of the better lawyers in the state to present their case to the jury. And then Mr. Mithoff, that it's all the excess carrier's fault, it's not the fault of the defendants.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. Take a short recess.